This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Dr. Danita Johnson-Hughes is the president and CEO of Edgewater Health here in Northwest Indiana, and she has written an interesting guest column that was published just recently in the Post Tribune that deals with three major issues that we are taking a look at here in the region in particular: pandemic, the police, and politics. And she is with us to talk about these topics, and thank you very much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Your thoughts in penning this particular guest column?
Well, Chris, I believe, you know, I thought about it because it just seems like our world is in such flux right now that we have all of these competing things going on, and in a sense, they're so very much related, particularly the issue with the pandemic, the coronavirus that's impacting our nation in a way that I can never even remember that we've been affected by it before. Mm-hmm. And of course, when there is such a pandemic or when there is a public health emergency, typically people of color suffer a bit more. They contract the disease at higher rates than others, and they die at higher rates than others. So in proportion to the general population, they're impacted in a much more devastating way. And then we've got the issues going on with the police. And again, another public health emergency. It has been, you know, our country suffers from an illness already, and that illness is racism. Mm-hmm. We've never gotten beyond that. It is a public health crisis. So we've got all of these things going on at one time. And in order to resolve them, it's going to take a concerted effort by everyone to make sure that we can eradicate our community of racism. Mm-hmm. It's a systemic problem. It's been going on forever, and it impacts the health and well-being of all of us, but particularly those populations of color.
Let's take each topic and break it out in more detail here. Let's begin first with the pandemic and your thoughts that you've got together in putting it together in this way: the pandemic, the police, and politics. Let's do the mm-hmm. pandemic first.
Okay, the pandemic. The fact is that, again, because of the raging health disparities that Black people are confronted with, that are a result of a number of social issues that impact them, such as poverty, poor education, economic systems. You know, all of these things converge to put African Americans, and that's who I'm talking about mostly mm-hmm. in this particular segment, put them in a position of not being able to adequately relieve themselves of the emotional and psychological distress of having these experiences every day, of living in a system where they're consistently confronted with adverse conditions, housing, homeless, you know, the homelessness issue, food deserts where they don't have enough food or they're not able to feed their families and provide housing for them. They're not able to access health care as much as others simply because of transportation issues or economic issues. And plus, a lot of people are distrustful of physicians, and they've been for years. They're just distrustful, and so they don't believe that they can trust their practitioners. So there are a number of things that really impact the way that Black people access care, and their systems are poorly funded. They don't get adequate health care, and it's all attributable to what I believe is systemic racism. Hmm. It contributes to the marginalization of people of color. As a result, they experience psychological distress, and that impacts their entire well-being. If you don't have good mental health, good physical health, and good social health, you don't have good health. So all of those things come together to create a wholesome, healthy individual and communities.
And let's take up the second point that's in your guest column, the police.
Okay, when it comes to the police, I think it's really important, and a lot of people, you know, some people may already know this and some people may not, but you have to think about how the whole police state came to being in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And how it came to being was that back in the 1700s, early 1700s, when there was slavery, they had these patrols, these slave patrols that were actually designated to go out, capture, apprehend runaway slaves. One of their objectives was also to deter revolt, so that the slaves would not revolt on the plantation, and they were created to create intimidation, fear amongst slaves, so that they wouldn't run away, so that they wouldn't revolt. And so I think that a lot of those attitudes have carried over into what has evolved into today's system of policing. It's the mentality of it, the whole idea of its construction. It has all come together to create a situation where, first of all, black people are not valued. Secondly, whether we believe it or feel it or are conscious about it or not, it's also a way to keep black people in their place. The overrepresentation of them in prison, which is 5 times the rate of the general population, they're killed 3 times more than others by police officers. And so all of this stuff has come together to create what I consider to be a public health crisis today.
And I also note that you mentioned in that particular segment on talking about the police that it isn't just, a problem of biased police officers. It goes beyond that.
It's not just biased police officers. It's a general, devaluation and marginalization of people of color. And I give the example in the article of the issue that's all front and center today with Ahmaud Arbery being hunted down, just like an animal, and killed by white people who just felt that his life was of no value. He's out jogging, and he's just hunted down and killed for sport. That's an issue. And then I think about our children who they grow up fearful of the police. When I was in school, I remember us having visits by the police officers and others, and they were considered officer friendly.
Mm-hmm.
But things have just sort of gone in a direction that really is just not healthy for our country. Ahmaud Arbery is not a police situation, but there are so many other situations that are not really directly related to the police. But it's not just the killing of people of color, of black people. It's just the opportunities that they're not allowed to take advantage of, like good educational systems, well-funded educational systems, like access to health care, especially in urban areas. Just so many things that they're not able to take advantage of because the system is designed to keep people from moving up, to move outside of those margins, that marginalization. So it's not just police officers. It's just a system of racism that has really harmed our country. I think a part of it is I really do believe that we have all these you've heard of them, where we have these trainings to create cultural awareness and cultural diversity and to help people to understand how to work with different groups, different professions, how to work with different groups. But I think what we need to do is a deeper dive.
Mm-hmm.
I think that what we really need to do is we need to go back and really analyze and evaluate how was this country founded and how in those days did certain people become marginalized, such as Native Americans, and then later on, people who were captured and who actually provided the capital on which this country was built, black people, Africans. So, I think people need to really look at the history, things like when they were protesting and talking about the president doing that rally. In Fed rally recently, where he didn't really think about the date of it, which was Juneteenth, and in Oklahoma, he didn't really understand and didn't even understand what they talked about when they talked about where it was located near Black Wall Street.
Yeah.
They didn't talk about that. And so those things are important in order to understand, you know, and to me, those are the kinds of things that when you look at them, here's a very prominent Black community in the 20s, and it was not allowed to continue because of racism.
We're talking with Dr. Danita Johnson-Hughes. She's the president and CEO of Edgewater Health. She's written a recent guest column that's been published in the Post-Tribune. The title of the column is The Pandemic, the Police, and Politics. And let's hear your views about politics now on that.
I really do believe that our country overall is unwell. Mm-hmm. As I've said in the article, I believe our democracy has failed us. This daily system of racial bias and injustice have impacted the physical, emotional, mental well-being of Black people in our country. And I give the example of the alcoholic uncle who's in denial about his addiction. Until he can come to grips with that addiction and take responsibility for the fact that he does have an ailment, and that if he doesn't take responsibility for it and acknowledge the pain and hurt that it has caused, it'll never get resolved. We have to think about, you know, where we are in our country today and what we can do to move beyond this. And we can move beyond this. It's just that we have to get people on the same page. And I think, as I mentioned, getting them on the same page means creating an understanding of where this all came from. It didn't just pop up because people have, they're just born with these attitudes, because they're not. This is a system of oppression that has occurred since the beginning of our country. And we need to look at how we begin to talk about not just being not a racist, but how we eliminate racism from all of our systems, from all of our institutions, and from our policy making and the decisions around that, so that everyone can have a fair opportunity to succeed. They have the same or economic opportunities, that we eradicate poverty. Because I think about all this money that we were able to come up with because of the pandemic in terms of the CARES program. Just think, if we could take that amount of money and put it towards eradicating poverty, creating better educational opportunities for our students, K through 12 and beyond, if we could take that amount of money and put it into rebuilding our country so that we can eliminate it, racism in our systems. We need to eradicate racism and racial injustice at the same time, and it can be done if we all have a like mind and if that's what we want to do.
It's interesting this should all come about, and this guest column come about at the time when Lakeshore Public Media is once again conducting another race and justice live conversation, talking about the subject here in particular in Northwest Indiana. And have you gotten any reaction to the column from anybody you've talked to since it came out in the Post Tribune?
Yes, I have. A couple of people, actually, and thanking me for writing it. And it was, you know, Black and white who thanked me for writing the column, and just wondering, though, how people will take it. Because, you know, I say that there are in the article, I say that there are things that white people cannot even imagine. They think they understand, but these are things that they haven't experienced and can't imagine, like your children being afraid of police officers. They've not experienced that. So, you know, It's hard to understand those kinds of things when it hasn't happened to you, or having to give that talk to your kids, and not just your sons these days, but your daughters as well. You know, how to react if you're ever stopped by a police officer, because they approach all of these encounters with trepidation. They are fearful, and so you have to tell them how to respond if they're ever stopped. You have, and they have to learn, you know, whether people believe it or not, being Black in America it fills you with a tension, anxiety, stress that most people, white people, don't experience. They don't have to think about these things when they wake up, but Black people do on a daily basis. They have to think about these things.
Well, it sounds like this is the reason why Edgewater Health is out there, as along with other organizations, is to help people that are having problems coping with things. And it's going to be an ongoing conversation, to be sure, besides just one that happens for the moment. And we thank you very much for spending some time to talk about this and going over your guest column with us today.
All right. Well, I appreciate you. Thanks, Chris.
You're welcome. Dr. Danita Johnson-Hughes is the president and CEO of Edgewater Health. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. The Lake County Public Library is going to start reopening its branches beginning on Monday with the major branch, the Central Branch, as it's called, or Central Library, which is in Merrillville. The Crown Point Community Library has already opened as a result of being prepared following the governor's Back on Track Indiana plan and all the procedures and work that has to be done to be able to reopen, at least on a limited basis. But let's find out more about how the Crown Point Community Library has been doing. Julie Wendell is the director for the library, and she's joining us from Crown Point, from the main library. We should mention also, too, they have a branch in Winfield, so that we talk about branches, which is what we're referring to. And Julie, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks for having me.
When you got the word, of course, they had to go to the lockdown, to the stay-at-home stage. Where was the Crown Point Community Library at the time? Was it just as usual operations and all of a sudden everything had to suddenly stop?
Actually, we were in preparations to that morning. We had already put in some social distancing over the weekend and prepared for being open for that Monday on March 16th. And as things were starting to progress, the schools had already been announced to be closed on Friday. And as things progressed very quickly on Monday, March 16th, we had an emergency board meeting, and then I was drafting our epidemic policy, and then suddenly we made the decision to close when the announcement that the restaurants were closing and that the amount of people that could be in one place was limited. So at that time, we closed within about an hour.
Mm-hmm. We should mention that if you've not been in the Crown Point Community Library, besides the usual complement of meeting rooms and of course, the stacks and everything that the people will come to visit to pick up books and other materials, they also have the little cafe in there, too. So you probably had to handle things differently because of that, didn't you?
Yes, definitely. Our library is really designed to be a community hub. We're right off steps off the of the downtown area in the square. So we get a lot of foot traffic, a lot of people in here that use the library as a studying place, a place to hang out, whether it's teens or students that are studying for college or seniors. But we have a lot of people that stay here. So that was our major concern, is those places where people gather in large numbers in the library. So those areas were closed immediately before we actually closed the building as a whole on Monday.
Now, when you had to close up, did the staff members just have to kind of work from home or whatever that they could do within their job limits to be able to keep things going, so to speak, until some point where you could come back in and do some work?
Correct. The library staff as a whole were working remotely from home starting later that week in March, and they did not return until May 11th.
Mm-hmm.
I tell people it was a very sad time for me because I was in this huge building all by myself every day working from the library, so I was very happy to have staff return in May so I could not be alone in the library. But, yeah, they were working and providing virtual services, whether they were doing phone reference for people that were calling in on cell phones, or they were providing virtual programming, doing taping and having programming on our YouTube channel, or issuing library cards for virtual items in our collection. So they were all very busy.
When you had the opportunity to get some operations back up where people could come, at least for a limited, very limited basis at the time, to be able to do something, where did that go first? Was that basically these computer opportunities, the computer stations that were set up outside the building?
Yeah, actually, we're really excited for that partnership that we had with the foundations of Lake County. The Crown Point Community Foundation, the Legacy Foundation, and the foundations of East Chicago came together to do a large emergency grant opportunity for people that were responding to COVID situations. So I applied for a grant there and was able to get funding for computer carts I had gotten the idea from another librarian friend in Pulaski County, she's the director over there, Mackenzie Ludley, and so glad that she had shown me this special cart that she actually purchased from her library for their county building. And we kind of used that idea to present the idea of having computer service outside of our location. So the grant was able to help us purchase those three computer carts, which we pushed out in May. Outside of the library, and that kind of complemented our outdoor Wi-Fi that we had already put into place in April. So we were able to provide people with the opportunity that need to print or scan or use a computer that didn't have their own device. So we're really excited about that.
Speaking of the Wi-Fi, how did that work out to have people come up in their cars and park in the parking lot close to the building so they could take advantage of the Wi-Fi connection? How many people, I guess, had to be operating only so close to, I guess you can only get so many people in before you start getting into the social distancing issue?
Well, there's a large municipal parking lot between the City Hall and the Crown Point Library, so that holds quite a few spots. And because of all the restaurants and other businesses closed, we could fit quite a few people in their cars there, and it was used quite widely. So that was great. And then our branch over in Winfield is in a shopping center, and that parking lot is quite large, much larger than the one we have here at Crown Point. So I wish I had parking like that here.
So at least you had a pretty big Wi-Fi coverage then, to be sure. That made out.
We had very large Wi-Fi coverage.
That's good. Yes.
And what was interesting is we had Wi-Fi, of course, in the building, but we had to then plan for how to get it outside. We didn't have coverage prior to the COVID emergency. So we wrangled one of our units and had it Velcroed outside on the top of the doorway with wires running out until we could get a supplier to come in and to mount it permanently and install that. So we were kind of proud of the way that we were able to MacGyver it for the short term.
Well, you have to do what you have to do. I know that makes sense in that respect. When you finally got the word that you could make the plans to start getting ready to reopen buildings, that was prior to the reopening officially on June 15th, what did you first have to realize to do? You had to get, I guess, if you hadn't looked at the guidelines to see what you had to be able to follow to make sure everything is correct and the social distancing is proper. What steps did you have to take?
Well, I, like many other leaders, were watching the governor when he announced all his back on track plan. And so we immediately took that plan and started looking at where the library fits into that and finding where the safest time was for us to be reopening. The first two dual things that I had to do was to make sure that I was balancing the safety of our staff along with the safety of our patrons. So there were lots of things I needed to put in place. Of course, shopping for supplies has been very difficult, trying to source materials like face masks or hand sanitizer and wipes and cleaning materials has been very difficult. Most of those supplies early on were being diverted to first responders, which was, of course, appropriate, but it made it really difficult for us to buy the things that we needed in bulk. But we were able to work with some of the partners here in Crown Point to get those things. I was able to work because I work at the farmer's market regularly, reach out to somebody that sewed face masks for our staff for us, and then also a Crown Point company here right down the street, VFK Renzel. We were able to go with them to create wonderful hanging sneeze guards that really are also cost-effective, but also very aesthetic and protect the staff and patrons at all of our public desks, too.
We're talking
that stuff took time to get into place.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Julie Wendell. She's the director of the Crown Point Community Library. They are open now on a limited basis as far as operations are concerned, but they are open. And, of course, as we mentioned earlier, that the Lake County Public Library will be opening up its first branch in Merrillville on Monday, the 29th. What would people see if they came in on the opening day or reopening day, maybe I should say, on June 15th? What would they see in the main library that's a little different than what it was before, besides some of the obvious things, like you mentioned the sneeze guards, for example?
I think they would see sneeze guards, see stickers on the floor showing social distancing and reminding people to make sure that they're not coming together. They'll see signs on some of our areas that are closed, letting them know that they're temporarily not available to use for patrons. We have greeters in the lobby just reminding people that we have kind of a grab-and-go service right now, mm-hmm. that you can come in and get your materials and to check out yourself. Also use our computers for about an hour at a time. and that there was really no lingering at the library because we need to keep our capacity in mind before we move into stage five. So that's really the main differences. The most disappointing thing, I think, for our kids is that our huge interactive play areas, both at both locations here at Crown Point and in Winfield, we had just installed and we're getting huge amount of visits to the library. We had to put those away temporarily because it's just not safe right now to have all those toys out for people to be handling at the same time. So that's probably what looks most different for kids is that the play area is not open, and they're kind of sad about that. But we're hoping to have it open as soon as it's safe.
Do you think with like every library that offers up rooms for the community to use, that it's just going to take a while before the meeting rooms are reopened for use in some capacity?
Yeah, we're still working through how we're going to move meeting rooms back to public use, but also for library programming use. Right now, we're at Crown Point. We are using those rooms for some meetings, but they're really for essential business. We had in April, and then actually tomorrow, we had a Red Cross blood drive, so we've opened our rooms for those kind of situations. We also have a partnership with MAD that does court-ordered victim panels, so we've opened our building for those, for the backup in the court system and parole that needed to have those victim impact meetings. So we're working with very essential things, but at this time, having parties or showers and things that we have happening a lot in our meeting rooms just aren't possible because of the number of people that can be in the room at one given time.
Now, Julie, when you and your colleagues there at the libraries, both of them, had the opportunity to be able to offer some contactless services, like being able to let people pick up items that they may have put on hold and make those available. How did you set it up in your particular building so folks could be able to get, say, a book or whatever that they might have had on hold in the past and they could actually pick up finally?
They were excited to get a phone call from us letting them know that they can come use our curbside pickup at both locations. So at Crown Point, we have that Monday through Friday from 10 to 6 p.m. And on at our branch, we have that just on Tuesdays and Thursdays available. But they just simply come and anytime they want and pull into one of our numbered spots and call in, and we just walk out the materials and hang it on a hook on those numbered spots. So it's been a really great way to serve the public. We've had over 1,000 pickups since May 18th. So those are really busy opportunities for people to get their materials. We're still continuing, even though we've opened last week, to do curbside for people that aren't just comfortable coming in the building at this time. But another way we've actually been serving is having take-and-make bags. And so we have those, have had those at the front door, even when we're closed, for people to come and take an activity, kids of all ages to come and get activity and do something at home. And we have oftentimes videos that are on our YouTube channel that coordinate with those bags.
I know that the Crown Point Community Libraries, both the main branch and the Winfield branch, have been like the Lake County Public Library branches have been able to offer this opportunity for people to pick up the materials and drop off materials, too. You may have had a little limited access to some of the drop-off boxes that are outdoors. And when those materials come back and they have to go into quarantine, what has been your procedure in being able to handle that? Because you have to basically keep them out of circulation for 72 hours.
Correct. In fact, one of the things I did when I was inside the building all those months is I handled the book drop. We didn't ever close our book drop here at Crown Point Library. So we had all those materials that people returned in quarantine for months. We were kind of prepared when staff came back so they could handle materials right away. Now we have a whole system of quarantining the materials for 72 hours, like you had said. We're really excited to have results of the Battelle science study that's being a partnership between the Battelle and the Institute of Museum and Library Services just came out with the results with definitive study showing that after 3 days or 72 hours that there is no evidence of any COVID virus on any library materials that have been heavily circulated. So that gives us a really great peace of mind that knowing that quarantine for 72 hours is really the best way to handle our materials.
Now, since the official reopening on June 15th, how has been the reaction from patrons who have been able to come by, aside from all the changes in the buildings that they have to get used to and the things they can't, unfortunately, still take advantage of because of the pandemic and the restrictions? How are they coping with the fact that, number one, they've got the library open, but they can't do quite what they used to be able to do?
I would say that people are thrilled to be able to get into get their materials. That's really making a lot of people happy, being able to get to the computers and use those for essential businesses and things that they need to get accomplished. I think this time really hits in the time that libraries always have their highest attendance at during summer reading. And although we're doing our summer reading virtually and having programming online, it's disappointing for some kids as they come in that are used to coming to large format programs. We'd have a performer, and we might have 200 people here for a program, and that's just not possible at this time. So that's somewhat disappointing to people. But when we let them know the different ways that we're providing programming and the crafts and some activities, they're really excited about that. We have some really neat story walks that we've done in the past that we have outside the library and also in conjunction with the storefronts in Crown Point Square location stores. So there's lots of things that we can point them to do other activities that they kind of replace what they've used to in the building. So that's been something that we've really been working hard on.
Now, I know we haven't mentioned it yet, that when people come back to check out materials, to look around, at least briefly, they're at the Crown Point Community Library, and they see people wearing masks. We know for sure that the staff members have to wear masks. Do patrons have to wear masks when they come in?
We're strongly encouraging patrons to wear masks. So we have signs at the front door and, of course, model that behavior by staff. But we're not requiring masks at this time.
Now, if anyone has any questions, maybe we've kind of covered some of the frequently asked questions, and you have a great listing on your website about that. Give us the address so people can go if they don't already know the web address for the Crown Point Community Library and where they can find out all this information to get some of their questions answered before they actually set foot into the library.
Sure. They can go to crownpointlibrary.org, and all the way down at the end, we have a COVID information page, so they can go there and click there, or they can call the library and ask any question they have too.
Julie Wendell is the director of the Crown Point Community Library, which of course has the main branch in downtown Crown Point as well as in Winfield. And thank you for being with us to give us all the updates, and we hope that the things continue to go well, that you get to open up more and more things in the library to make available for your patrons.
Thank you so much, Chris.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and let's check in on the community of Valparaiso. Mayor Matt Murphy is with us. Good morning, Mayor. Thanks for joining us on the program today.
Good morning, Chris. Great to be with you.
Not long ago, I understand you had a news release and information out about the concerns about equality in your city, in particular in light of the incidents that have happened, of course, and the discussions that are underway, including one that the community discussion that we're going to have here, another of the Race and Justice series here on from Lakeshore Public Media. And tell us how the city of Valparaiso is dealing with the issues, especially as it involves how law enforcement and the community work together.
Sure. Well, that's a great question. It's an important issue today. Obviously, the entire nation has been impacted by the tragic death of George Floyd now about a month ago on May 25th. And so we felt that we have a pretty good story to tell here in Valparaiso in terms of having a human relations commission and fostering inclusion and fairness. And, we have a group of folks that they get together and they discuss issues of diversity, equity, inclusion, and they're an active council. And we rely on them for a host of issues. And we also felt that we have I wanted to highlight this, and something I want to emphasize to the listeners is that when it comes to policing, Our Valparaiso Police Department is an absolutely fantastic group of well-trained individuals, and they have long made fairness and community policing a top priority. We're one of just 13 police departments in the state of Indiana that is accredited by the Commission of Accreditation for Law Enforcement Agencies, CALEA for short, and just 500 nationwide. And this opens our policies in our police department to rigorous oversight and review. Our police department works consistently to strengthen community relationships. We have a popular Citizens Police Academy and a Junior Academy. We do multiple programs within our schools and frequent opportunities for interactions with our residents. So we have a coffee with a cop and breakfast and badges. And what I want to point out is these programs are not new. They're not a reaction to the events in Minneapolis. These are things we've been doing and it really has paid off. And it's just a testament to the leadership of our police chief, Jeff Ballin, who's done a fantastic job leading our police department, and we're very proud of that.
I understand that Chief Ballin gets a chance to meet often with members of the community and also with the groups like the Human Relations Council to be able to talk about issues, to help answer questions and the like.
Absolutely. He is a great communicator, great listener. He is a bridge builder in our community. He has regular conversations with not only the Human Relations Council to review department statistics and outreach efforts. He was last year, Chief Ballin was honored for his diversity efforts by the Northwest Indiana African American Alliance. Mm-hmm. He's the real deal. He's a man of action, and we're very proud of him.
Do you find that it's been easier in taking office as mayor and your other, of course, tenure as a councilman in the past, in being able to get the community of Valparaiso behind, in this case, the police department, but behind the government in general, to help at least bring up the issues and talk about them and not let it get to the point where it goes to real serious and angry protests?
Yeah, a lot of the work was done in the past, and so like I said, it's paying off today. The efforts that the police department and through its leadership of Mayor Costas, those are all things that we're not reacting to. Those are things we're going to continue to do, mm-hmm. and they're paying off. In terms of the city and the community, we've had a very strong city government, which I've been proud to be a part of, and now to serve as a season as mayor. Even more proud, and you can really see the tremendous leadership we have in the city that will address these issues in a positive way, and you know we're going to continue to work through that, and we'll get through this difficult season.
We're talking with Valparaiso Mayor Matt Murphy, and before we get to some good news to pass along about the upcoming holiday, Mayor Murphy, let's talk about how the city of Valparaiso and the citizens and businesses and the like are coping with the pandemic, with seeing more places open up and more people get out and around here. How have things been handled so far, and areas that you'd like to maybe tweak a little bit if you could?
Well, you know, the community just stepped up tremendously. They, as sort of expected here in Valparaiso, we've also been blessed to not have huge numbers of infected residents. And our Porter Hospital and St. Mary's have just done a great job of keeping us informed. And also our Porter County Health Department and the county, they do a great job of communicating every single day the numbers. And so we're monitoring that every day, so that if we need to tweak some of our policies, we can. Also, Governor Holcomb was doing a press conference Monday through Friday. He's now backed off to Monday, Wednesday, Friday, but we're getting great communication from both the state and the county to make decisions that we need to make to keep our residents safe, and so that's helped tremendously as well.
Well, that's good to hear. Speaking of how things are happening in the community of Valparaiso and as dealing with the pandemic, we know it's had to make some changes in what you wanted to do, but it looks like that 4th of July is going to happen as scheduled in Valparaiso. A little different arrangements. Tell us about how everything is arranged and how Family Express is partnering with the city to make it all happen.
Yeah, we really appreciate the partnership with Family Express. We felt they were an ideal partner for this community event. They very supportive, community-minded company, and they've been also providing a lot of leadership and hygiene and safety throughout the pandemic. So we're pleased to have their support, and I think it's going to be a great event. And so the whole, you know, we waited as long as we could. We weren't sure what the summer events were going to look like. The state hadn't put out a lot of guidance, but when Governor Holcomb put forth the Indiana Back on Track plan, and on July 4th, the state opened up the amount of people that could gather. We felt that a modified series of events would be great to kick off our freedom from hopefully not going back to where we were in terms of a pandemic. So we modified the event in a couple of ways. Number one, we made it a ticketed event for Valparaiso residents only inside the Urschel Field viewing area. Now, you got to keep in mind, you know, if you're not in the commercial field viewing area, it doesn't mean you can't enjoy the fireworks.
Yeah.
So if you don't get a ticket, one of the tickets, you know, you can still try to find a spot in an area nearby and enjoy a beautiful, tremendous fireworks show that we're very proud of. So we had an engineering firm actually crunch the numbers to see how many folks we could safely fit in that Urschel Field viewing area, keeping in mind social distancing, and that number is what we based our ticket number on. Mm-hmm. So those tickets will be available to Valparaiso residents. You have to be our city resident tonight, beginning at 6 o'clock. We'll be queuing up at the Urschel Pavilion downtown near Central Park Plaza, and they'll be offered for free to city residents with a maximum ticket, six per city household.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how we kind of modified that. We didn't want to have to do that, but we felt that that would be the prudent measure this year. Also, Chris, as you know, a lot of surrounding communities decided to cancel 4th of July, so we kind of feel like we might get some folks from other parts of Northwest Indiana to come to Valpo that day. So we really wanted to just take an extra precaution to make sure we weren't overwhelmed there in the Urschel viewing area. So that's one major modification to our 4th of July event.
Now, we separate now the fireworks and the concert are in two different locations for good reasons. And is it going to seem to work out to have the fireworks there at Urschel Field and then have the concert downtown there at Central Park Plaza?
Yeah, we wanted to spread it out. So we start early in the morning, 7:30 in the morning. We've got a 4th of July blast, 5K and a 2K run walk with a staggered start to allow for social distancing. That's going to be at 7:30. Then at 10 a.m., we're going to have our first ever Lift Up Valpo Parade downtown, mm-hmm. which is going to include Valpo businesses, first responders, and others. The parade will be all vehicles and contactless, similar to the recent, very successful Valparaiso High School graduation parade. That route will begin at Valparaiso High School, heading south on Campbell, east on Lincoln Way, and ending at Morgan. During that time, from 8 to 1, we'll have the Valparaiso Market, which features local farmers and artisans, and they're located at the William E. Urschel Pavilion at Central Park Plaza. Then, at 8:30 in the evening, a free concert. Tickets are required, again, because we've got to limit the amount of folks we can gather in the park there.
Right.
I think it's 600. You don't have to be a Valparaiso resident to get a ticket. Those tickets are available at ValparaisoEvents.com. I believe they went on They went up for availability noon yesterday. Mm-hmm. That'll be featuring the Craw Puppies at the Porter Health Amphitheater from 8:30 to 10. And then at 9 o'clock on the north side of town at Urschel Field, as we discussed, we kick off our traditional fireworks hosted by Valparaiso Parks with the partnership of Family Express.
Well, it sounds like you've got it all laid out, and you and the folks with Valpo Parks and others in city government have got this all well planned out, and let's hope that everything goes well, that the weatherman cooperates in this case, too, which I'm sure he or she probably will. But we appreciate you telling us all about it, and the best of luck to you, Mayor, for keeping up on things in the community, and we'll be back with you soon, I hope.
Thanks a lot, Chris. Anytime. Take care.
Thank you. We'll be talking with Valparaiso Mayor Matt Murphy. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us today. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we will have Joe Pete from the Times of Northwest Indiana to tell about the stories that he's put out in print and online, and a conversation with IU Northwest Economics Professor Micah Pollack. We hope you can join us.